1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, and 16 to 23. In this discourse, I want to start a short series on the life of Jonathan. Now, Jonathan is one of the lesser characters of the Bible. Yet, on the whole, he is a great character. He's the most gracious, generous man, brave, bold and courageous, a very happy combination in a young man. Courageous and gracious, generous and bold and brave. Perhaps he was not always wise, as we shall see, and perhaps he was not always consistent. But in this first discourse to this lesser character of the Bible, Jonathan, I want to set the background, and I do so from 1 Samuel 13, 1 to 7, and 16 to 23. Here we are introduced to Jonathan, and we come across him when his father is king, chapter 13, verse 1, Saul was king. Now the first verse is very difficult as far as the manuscripts go and the various renderings of this, and the dates and the numbers and so on. But the fact is, Saul is king. And in verse 2, we are told that Saul has chosen 3,000 men from Israel. And he's divided his camp into two. 2,000 with him at Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel. And 1,000 with his son Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. Now, what do we learn from this? What do we see here? On the best evidence I have, that Saul had been king for 2 years now. So Jonathan, his son, is probably about 20, at the most in his early 20s, and Saul is in his mid-40s. The dates are difficult. We'll learn at the end of their lives that Saul and Jonathan die together in battle, when Saul was probably in his 70s, and Jonathan in his mid to late 40s. So, of course, Jonathan and David, who are linked so closely in Scripture, were near contemporaries, over a period stretching from about, say, 5, 10, or 15 years. Jonathan is slightly older than David. Now, we know that Israel had clamored for a king, chapter 8, verse 5. We know that Samuel's sons had been a disaster, chapter 8, verse 2, and Israel demanded a king. Especially chapter 8 verse 20 and 12 verse 12, they demanded a king who would be a military king. They wanted to be like the world, to be like the nations. They were warned, chapter 8 verses 9 to 18, but they still clamored and they got a king. Now Saul has saved Israel in the sense of Jabesh Gilead, in chapter 11. And the Philistines had been defeated under Samuel in chapter 7. And all the days of Samuel, chapter 7, the Philistines were subdued. So we see a vacuum in Israel after Samuel. You see, Samuel's sons were no use whatsoever. And so Israel clamored for a military king, and they got Saul. And that's the background here. Now I jump to chapter 13, verses 19 to 21. Saul and Jonathan are in their various camps. And we're told this: not a blacksmith could be found in the whole land of Israel, because the Philistines had said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plowshares, mattocks, axes and sickles sharpened. The price was 2/3 of a shekel for sharpening plowshares and mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for sharpening forks and axes, and for repointing goads. Now do you read this as something happened, something that came about after the episode we're going to look at now, or start to look at, or is it the background to that episode? Now, I take it to be the background to that episode. This is common, I think, in Hebrew history. The explanation comes late. In other words, in chapter 13, verse 1, where we're starting, Saul is king, and he divided his men, 2,000 with him and 1,000 with Jonathan. But Israel as a whole are in hock to the Philistines. They're subdued. They're subjugated by the Philistines. They have no weapons. There are only two swords in Israel. Jonathan has one, and Saul has the other. To get their weapons sharpened, they have to go to the Philistines, and their weapons are farmyard instruments. The Philistines are in dominance here. Israel is under threat. And what does Saul do with this threat? He chooses 3,000 men. Now that's a bad mistake. 3,000 is far too high to guard him, but it's far too low to fight the Philistines. And then he does the thing worse. He actually divides his camp into two. 2,000 with him, and 1,000 with Jonathan. So he provokes the Philistines. He makes a foolish mistake in this. He divides his army. It's too small to fight. And he just simply makes a provocation to the Philistines. But of course it means, trying to pick up about Jonathan, that he must have been a man of caliber. If men would follow him, 1,000 men would follow him in his early 20s or 20, it shows a remarkable character. There's never a hint in Scripture that he couldn't do the job. There's never a hint that the men would not follow him. It speaks highly of this man. He is a real man. He's not a womanish man, if you can. I don't want to be pejorative, but he's not in any way weak or soft or soppy. He's a real strong man. He's not depending and hanging on his father's coattails. But as we see these two men, the young man with in one camp and the father sitting with his men in another camp, the people, I take verses 19 to 21, are disillusioned. They don't want the king to fight their battles, and all he can do is sit around, as it were, running courts and looking grand. He's playing at soldiers, but he's doing no good at all. He likes the trappings of kingship. He likes the trappings of war, but he can't fight. And therefore the people are in this bondage. They have no proper weapons. They're fighting with farmyard materials and forges and weapons. They have to get these forged and sharpened by the Philistines. And so Israel is under the control, the jackboot, of the Philistines. It's only the Philistines who have the modern armor and weapons. They're fighting with bows and arrows, slings and clubs, mattocks, and so on. It reminds me of Poland trying to fight Germany in the Second World War, trying to hold off the Blitzkrieg with horse cavalry. It's hopeless. Israel is depressed, afraid. It's got show, but it's got no reality of power at all. They're cowering and frightened. They're disappointed in Saul. They're afraid of the Philistines. He's playing at being a king. Who's going to do anything about it? Does Saul know what to do? Not a clue. Not a clue. He's just sitting with his 2,000 men. I think this is the background. A weak, depressed, disappointed people, hemmed in. No one knowing what to do. And this is the background to the life of Jonathan. For what we read, and I'll take it on in my next discourse, that we read that Jonathan attacked the Philistines. Verse 3. Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it, and so on. It was Jonathan who took the action. But before we get to that, let me just pause here and leave it here. Here is the background. Israel, depressed, in bondage, not knowing what to do, rudderless, guideless. They have a king in name, but it's hopeless. Is there any parallel for us? Well, I'm cynical, I'm an old man, that's what people will say. But the truth is from where I'm sitting, I live in England. The church is in the West. Although there's much show and pomp and playing at Christianity. There's so little power, there's so little vigor, there's so little life of the Spirit manifest amongst us. We've set up our entertainment halls. We set up our big business organizations. We call them churches. We've set up our priestcraft. We have posh names for it all, but that's what it amounts to. But none of that will deliver sinners from the jaws of hell and Satan. We want the power of God's Spirit. We want the glory of God. We want men who know what to do and know how to use weapons. Men who are men, spiritually speaking. We want the men of the equivalent of Jonathan with the sword of the Lord in their hand. Not a physical sword. I'm not appealing for that. But the sword of the Spirit. Young men, perhaps, who know what to do and do it and take the steps that's necessary. We're disillusioned. Islam is riding high. Buddhism, four sects of every kind, they're growing, I'm sure. And the churches seem powerless. Now, people will say, well, I'm cynical and old, as I say, and dismiss it. Let them say what they will. I must speak my mind. We need men that God will fill and use. Young men, perhaps. Perhaps a young man listening to me now. We want Christ preached. We want the gospel preached. We want holiness amongst the saints. We want spirituality in the churches. We want a return to Scripture. I've been thinking about Ichabod. You remember the ark was taken by the Philistines. Israel had taken the ark into war as a superstitious talisman. You remember all the trouble about it and the anxiety about it. You remember the Phinehas's wife died and she produced a son as she was dying and called him Ichabod. The glory has departed. It seems that she was the only one, virtually, that knew what was going on. They all trembled about the ark, but it was the presence of God. The glory has departed. God is gone. It's not simply the box. It was God who was not among them in power. You remember when Moses built the tabernacle, and everything was finished, it was all in order, and he could go in the tabernacle and so on, but when the glory of the Lord came upon the tabernacle, he could not go in. That's what we need today. Seems to me that Jonathan is in the same ilk and vein as this, and he has the same message for us. A young man, but as we shall see, living in a time of depression, sadness, lowness, ignorance, paralyzed people. Jonathan, this young man, so limited in resources, nevertheless, he knows what to do, and he takes the step. I think the cause of Christ, the gospel, needs God to raise up such men as this. I say again, is there a young man listening to me? A young woman listening to me? Who will have some influence in some way, some believer somewhere, who will raise the cry for God. Not the physical sword, but the sword of the Spirit, so that Israel, believers, may yet again rise over the Philistines.